Representative Fassler has constitutional rights, and he's not been criminally charged yet. To ask for his resignation, it's a bold step.
House Democrats seek clarity and resolution on the allegations against Representative Fassler. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 30th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, opposition and support for the Ambler Road proposal.
It's not an easy life living out there, and especially when there's no jobs.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. You can nominate your favorite teacher at bpteachers.com. The deadline is February 1st.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
House Speaker Bryce Edgman says Representative Zach Fassler hasn't responded to House Majority Leader's requests that he resign. Edgman, a Dillingham Democrat, said in a press availability this morning that the caucus is giving Fassler time. A woman alleged that Fassler slapped her repeatedly, rupturing her eardrum when she denied his sexual advances.
Representative Fassler has constitutional rights, and he's not been criminally charged yet. To ask for his resignation, it's a bold step. And it's something that we acted fairly definitively and very quickly on because, quite frankly, our policy towards inappropriate treatment and certainly violence towards anyone, much less a woman, is something we just won't tolerate.
Edgman says any further steps, such as expelling Fassler from the majority or from the legislature, won't be determined until after lawmakers hear from the Bethel Democrat, who took office last year. Edgman says the allegations have been shocking to caucus members who have worked closely with Fassler. He says they honor the woman's courage in coming forward.
I know Zach well, and I truly wish him the best. And knowing him as I do, I think he's going to make a decision that will certainly be best for him, but I think he's also keeping the caucus in mind. And so it's my hope that his decision will come sooner than later.
Fassler hasn't appeared in the Capitol since James Brooks of the Juneau Empire reported the allegations on Saturday. Yesterday, the U.S. Senate rejected a bill to ban most abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancies. Senator Lisa Murkowski was one of only two Republicans to vote no on the procedural motion. Murkowski says she opposes late-term abortions and could be in favor of a ban on elective procedures after 20 weeks, provided the bill was adequate with exceptions in cases of rape and incest, or if the woman is at risk of grave harm to her health. Murkowski says the bill fell short.
I think that there are some exceptions that have been included that are very narrow, and in my view, almost unworkable.
Murkowski says the bill was an effort to send a political message rather than a realistic effort to pass a limitation on the procedure. Senator Dan Sullivan voted yes, as did most Republicans, including Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa. Ernst says a fetus at that stage is a child.
At 5 months, babies have grown nails on their fingers and on their toes. Hair has just begun to grow on their heads, and an ultrasound can tell an expectant mother or father whether their baby is a boy or a girl.
As expected, the procedural vote fell far short of the 60 needed to break a filibuster. The tally was 51 to 46. The window for public comment on a controversial road comes to a close this week. The Ambler Road would start at the Dalton Highway and stretch west for more than 200 miles. That's a big road in a state with not that many of them. Proponents say it will enable the growth of the mining industry and create jobs. Detractors worry about impacts to subsistence and the environment. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravina Koenig reports.
Ambler Road is an idea that's been kicking around for decades, but it picked up steam back in 2011. At that time, the price of oil was high, the state had cash, and Governor Sean Parnell wanted to put some of that money toward encouraging natural resource development in parts of the state that were off the road system. Ambler Road was part of that push.
You can't develop the Ambler Mining District without a road.
That's Rick Van Nieuwenhuyse, CEO and president of Trilogy Metals. His company is currently exploring the rich copper deposit tucked into the southern part of the Brooks Range. Van Nieuwenhuyse says that without a road, there just isn't an economical way to get the minerals to market if they do decide to start mining there.
We've looked at this very seriously, looking at aircraft and using airships that aren't in commercial use, but they're sort of in the planning stages, and the math just doesn't work.
So here's the state's proposed solution: a private industrial road, 211 miles long, running from east to west along the south side of the Brooks Range. Picture a road that starts at the heart of Alaska's interior and makes a beeline for the Chukchi Sea and Kotzebue, stopping near a group of Kobuk River villages. Wilmer Bedis is first chief of Hughes, one of the villages close to the east end of the proposed road. He says that residents in Hughes support the project because they believe it will translate to construction and mining jobs.
Right now we're in a deficit, and we've been in the last couple of years, and it really hurts the economy around here. It's not an easy life living out here, and especially when there's no jobs.
But other residents in the area are opposed. Vanessa Edwards is the acting tribal administrator of Alatna, another community close to the proposed road. She says that the benefits that might come from a road don't compare to the potential damage the project could do to important subsistence resources.
That Ambler mining road would cross two rivers that would directly affect us. That's the Kaikuk River and the Alatna River. And that's where sheepfish and whitefish go to spawn.
There are also concerns about how the road might affect the caribou population. Cyrus Harris lives in Kotzebue and is the vice chair of the Western Arctic Caribou Herd Working Group. At a meeting of that group earlier this winter, he expressed worry over how the project might affect a critical resource for his community.
Caribou is our main source of meat back home, unlike beef and so forth that the urban folks depend on. Well, we depend on the land being our garden, and that's how we were raised from time immemorial.
All of these sentiments are currently being collected by the Bureau of Land Management. The agency will use those public comments in its assessment of the impacts of the project, including economic, environmental, and subsistence impacts.
Wildlife biologists, engineers, hydrologists, fisheries biologists, we have a sociologist slash economist who will be involved with the analysis as well.
Tim Lamar is overseeing the process for BLM. The agency will have to decide whether or not to grant a permit to build the road through federal land, and if so, what the requirements will be to mitigate the environmental impact. BLM could deny the permit, but that's pretty rare.
I've never seen that in my career. That's not to say it hasn't happened.
The state agency leading the project, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or ADA, estimates that it could cost up to $380 million to build. It expects to finance that price tag through a mix of private capital, bonding, and tolls. The completion of the environmental review process isn't a done deal yet. So far, ADA has only paid for the scoping and some of the analysis that happens directly afterward. An ADA spokesperson said that once the scoping is complete, the ADA board will decide the next step. The public comment period is open through Wednesday, January 31st. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig. Elizabeth Harbaugh also contributed to this report.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, exposing weak spots in the disaster safety net.
You know, this is one of those that people would write off as unrealistic. Let's have a power failure and then an earthquake.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Two Fairbanks schools were put on lockdown this morning after a man was reportedly walking around a subdivision wearing camouflage and carrying a gun. He was arrested by police early this afternoon. Police patrolled the area for about 2 hours trying to find him. Fairbanks North Star Borough School District spokesperson Rebecca Herbie says school officials locked down an elementary school and a middle school in the area and ordered a second elementary school to lock its doors and remain on alert.
The police contacted us and said there was an armed suspect in the Aurora subdivision, and they told us to put Ann Ween and Randy Smith in lockdown. So at about 11 a.m., Ann Ween and Randy Smith went into lockdown. And we also ended up putting Joy Elementary into Sit Tight as a precaution.
Herbie says Sit Tight is a lesser form of security response that mainly involves locking the entrances to a school building.
A Sit Tight is when the building is secured, so the doors are locked, but classes continue as normal inside the school building. A lockdown is basically a grade higher, and that's when the building is secure, so it's locked, but then all the classrooms are closed off and locked, the lights go off, the students are brought away from the windows, and they basically nothing is happening until after the lockdown is done with.
Fairbanks police issued a Nixle alert around 11 a.m., warning Aurora area residents about the gunman and advising them to stay in their homes and lock the doors. Police were unavailable as of 4 this afternoon to provide information about the suspect. The earthquake and tsunami warning that rattled Alaskans last week exposed weak spots all over the disaster safety net. An unfortunate coincidence struck the Alaska Earthquake Center in Fairbanks that night.
20 minutes or so before the earthquake occurred, unrelated, Golden Valley Electric Association had a modest regional power outage.
State seismologist Michael West, director of the Earthquake Center, testified about the fluke to the U.S. Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee today. West said the outage shut off network equipment at the Geophysical Institute, where the Earthquake Center is housed on the campus of the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
So essentially, the Alaska Earthquake Center, all of its data and products were dark for about an hour or so. Yeah, not a proud moment, really.
The center collects data from about 130 seismic monitoring stations around the state. It's what West calls the backbone of earthquake monitoring in Alaska. But the Tsunami Warning Center had other stations supplying information. If the earthquake had been catastrophic, West says the data outage might have been a problem for responders trying to determine which communities were hardest hit. West told committee chair Lisa Murkowski this was a known vulnerability.
We've been clear with stakeholders for several years now that we do not have backup systems in place. We do not have modern continuity of operations. The reason's fairly simple.
He said his revenue sources, state and federal, have been pared back. After the hearing, West said the bad timing was fairly astounding.
I know. When we develop in-house scenarios to test, you know, this is one of those that people would write off as unrealistic. Let's have a power failure and then an earthquake.
A spokesperson at the Fairbanks utility confirms the power failure was unrelated to the quake. She says heavy snow fell on a distribution line, briefly cutting power to part of the city. Alaska Governor Bill Walker is asking the federal government to cut back its plan to open more of the state's coastal waters to oil development. On Tuesday, Walker made public a letter he sent to Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke asking that lease sales be limited to the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas and Cook Inlet. Alaska's congressional delegation recently made a similar request. Zinke's offshore leasing proposal originally opened 90% of federal waters to potential oil leasing. That plan has since changed as several states have asked to be excluded. Walker says that plan has created the false impression that the federal government is attempting to develop the entire coast of the state. In his letter, Walker asked Zinke's Interior Department to talk to tribes, Native corporations, and others in the areas where lease sales have been proposed. Walker says the state has been talking to those stakeholders and heard concerns. Walker also asked that the Interior Department honor longstanding exclusions for the Kaktovik and Barrow Whaling areas and a 25-mile coastal buffer. Unalaska's mayor will face a recall election in March. Frank Kelty has been accused of backroom dealings regarding the city dock, accusations he has repeatedly denied. In an investigation, KUCB has been unable to find any evidence of wrongdoing. But as KUCB's Zoe Sobel reports, those in favor of the recall say they have other concerns about Kelty's leadership.
In October 2017, a petition to recall Mayor Frank Kelty was issued with one charge: attempting to sole source land use agreements for the city dock. The petition's sponsors have accused the mayor of giving one shipping company, Matson, first crack at an agreement that would give it priority mooring at a section of dock. City code requires a public bidding process. But beyond making the allegation, none of the 10 sponsors have offered any proof that the mayor has negotiated illegal deals.
There's a legal definition of proof, and then there is the evidence that the sponsors believe supports the allegation.
That's Dee Montier Burke, who helped research and write the recall petition.
We are not lawyers. We cannot provide proof to the public that this happened because there's a lot of things that we do not have access to.
A KUCB public information request for Kelty's emails referencing dock agreements did not reveal any wrongdoing by the mayor. But between October 1st, 2016 and October 13th, 2017, Kelty did exchange about a dozen emails with Matson representative Marion Davis that mentioned dock agreements. Matson repeatedly pressed Kelty on the issue, asking him to help the company obtain a formal agreement. While Kelty seemed to share Matson's desire to complete the deal, there is no mention of specific contracts or negotiations in the emails. Kelty denies he was involved in any misconduct.
To state that I was going behind the council's back and behind administration's back, trying to cut my own agreement for Matson lines is a total falsehood and couldn't happen. I'm not able to do that as a mayor. Agreements are put together by the city manager's office.
A preferential use agreement is similar to a long-term lease on a house. The city guarantees a company space for its boats to dock. Here's former city manager Dave Martinson explaining how those agreements benefit Onalaska.
The city can obtain long-term guaranteed revenue. That revenue then is useful in ensuring the city can meet its obligations. Our local processors are better protected and the labor force used at the UMC is not affected.
Matson had an agreement with the city, but it expired in 2013 due to stalled tariff negotiations. The deal has continued informally since then. In a statement, Matson's Kenneth Gill says that beyond Onalaska, the company has had preferential use agreements in Kodiak and Anchorage for decades. Quote, in order to provide a reliable weekly service to Onalaska, we need to be able to count on the availability of facilities and plan for the long term, end quote. Matson owns the container crane on Onalaska's dock and provides regular barge service for mail and groceries. Despite those benefits, Onalaska hasn't opened a public bidding process for dock agreements, at least not yet. Former city manager Dave Martinson said he wasn't against those agreements. He just wanted to wait until the city's major dock renovation was finished.
Because we don't know what operationally that all is going to look like post-construction. I also indicated that at the time that we understood that, we would do a request for proposal. And a request for proposal allows many companies to compete.
Days before his September resignation, Martinson said multiple companies had expressed interest in dock agreements and that the Ports and Harbor Department was working on a request for proposals. But today, Matson has no such agreement negotiated by Kelty or anyone else. And Kelty says the alleged dock deal isn't really why people wanted to recall him. He says residents are upset because he beat former Mayor Shirley Marquardt and because the city manager resigned controversially.
The only way they could come after me is to go with the recall route, because otherwise it would be the next election for me is 2 years.
Petitioner Dee Montier Burke doesn't deny that. She voted for Kelty, but now she's unhappy with his leadership. So even without proof of an illegal deal, she says she's comfortable moving forward with the recall.
It's clear that there's something going on that seems fishy, and that's enough for the petition. But at this point, the petition is no longer about really the allegation of itself. It's about do the citizens of the community of Onalaska, do they feel like the mayor is of sound body and mind to continue to leave them on the state and federal stages?
The initial application for the recall petition included three other charges, but City Clerk Margie Veter determined the only sufficient charge was attempting to sole source land use agreements. When asked by KUCB which part of city code backed up that charge, Veter was unable to do so. The recall election is scheduled for March 6th. In Onalaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Family Education Loan so parents, a spouse, or grandparents can help students with the cost of college or training programs in or outside of Alaska. Interest rates are lower than the Federal Plus, and no credit is required. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in.
A warmer Arctic means big changes for sea ice and the animals that depend on it. But a new paper shows how warmer ocean temperatures are impacting animals on land in the Arctic as well. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Jennifer Pemberton has more about what this means for Alaska's muskox population.
What happens in the Arctic Ocean doesn't stay in the Arctic Ocean. Warmer waters are changing what happens on land, too.
What we're seeing is that events that are weather triggered offshore, originating in the oceans, are having onshore consequence on land mammals.
Joel Berger is a biologist at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, but his field sites of choice have been in western Alaska and Russia's Wrangel Island in the Chukchi Sea. He studies polar bears, the poster child for climate change in the Arctic, he says. But he has a special place in his heart for another Arctic animal.
Scientists aren't supposed to say this, but they might fall in love with the animals they study. Clearly, that's the case between muskox and me.
The muskox is basically a giant circumpolar goat. It's well adapted to living in the far north. It hunkers down in the winter, conserving energy by not moving around a lot, a kind of waking above ground hibernation. It also has a long coat and special woolly undercoat called kiviet. It's 8 times warmer than sheep wool, Berger says, perfect for winter field work on the tundra.
So I lost my hat. It was a gift to me, my kiviet hat, and I am so bummed. Maybe somebody hearing this interview will feel sorry for me and get me one.
For thousands of years, muskoxen have dealt with all the blows of the Arctic. But things are changing.
Summers are longer, winters are shorter, but we're also seeing more rain on snow events.
Rain on snow. That sounds like something that happens in Juneau every week during the winter.
Your listeners are going to be thinking, what? We get this all the time. Why is that a problem?
It's a problem because rain in the Arctic instantly turns to ice when it hits the frozen ground, trapping the low vegetation that muskoxen depend on. But this isn't having the effect that you might think. They're not starving to death.
And it's particularly serious if, in fact, females are pregnant and gestating.
It's at the end of their pregnancy, in February, March, and April, when the rapid growth of their babies is most susceptible to being impacted by rain-on-snow events. And when there's diminished food for the mother during this last trimester, her babies are runtier, Berger says. When his team measured them at 1, 2, and 3 years old, they had smaller heads than others whose mothers had experienced fewer rain-on-snow events during their pregnancies. In general, smaller animals have higher mortality rates, and if they survive, they reproduce at lower rates, which means that one winter storm in the Arctic that brings rain instead of snow can result in a nutritionally deprived baby that will have lower odds of growing up and reproducing. The ripple effect here, you can see, is serious.
But even subtle rain on snow events can have these kind of prolonged effects on young muskox.
So far, Berger and his team have tracked these impacts on the first 3 years of the animal's life, and they've seen that a 3-year-old muskox will still carry the impact of a rain-on-snow event that happened when it was in utero. Berger's on his way back to Wrangel Island in Russia next month to check on the now 4-year-old muskoxen. It's unknown at this point whether these runtier individuals might just be able to make up for their small size later in life. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
On Wednesday morning, early rising Alaskans and a few night owls will be treated to a celestial trifecta, a super blue blood moon. A supermoon is when the moon will be at its closest to the Earth, making it appear bigger and brighter. It's also a blue moon because it's the second full moon of the month. And it's a lunar eclipse, causing the moon to appear blood red for the same reason our sunsets look red. The Earth's atmosphere will scatter blue light and cast the moon in red, while also casting our planet's shadow on the moon. Omega Smith is the planetarium manager at the University of Alaska Anchorage. She says it's the first super blue blood moon in about 150 years.
It's a pretty spectacular event, but it is pretty much going on all night long, so it's not something that's just one moment. So for astrophotographers, you can go out and capture as the shadow of the Earth goes across the moon, and it makes some spectacular photos.
She says full moons aren't normally great for stargazers because the light normally drowns out the stars.
But as the Earth kind of takes away some of the light, kind of casts a shadow across the moon, you'll notice a lot of background stars easier to see because the lunar light's not drowning them out. So it's really good to go actually view stars and pull out your telescopes and look at deep sky objects on a lunar eclipse as well.
The eclipse will begin around 2:45 a.m., peaking at about 4:30 a.m. to 5 a.m., and will end around 7 a.m. The National Weather Service says the moon watchers in Anchorage will see partially cloudy skies with clouds lessening in the Palmer-Wasilla area. Nome to Fairbanks in the interior will have clear skies. Meteorologist Brian Besnick says in Juneau and southeast Alaska, the prospects aren't great.
The northern half of the panhandle, which would include the city of Juneau, and the surrounding area, there'll be a little bit better chance of seeing the lunar eclipse when it happens. However, I'm thinking that it's going to be fairly cloudy. There might be a few breaks that would allow you to view it.
Cooler temperatures may help with clearer skies. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Trip Krause, Rosh McChesney, and Jennifer Pemberton in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Ravenna Koenig and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station.
The Federal Subsistence Board is accepting applications through February 2nd to fill seats on the 10 Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. Councils meet at least twice a year and provide critical advice to the board on subsistence management issues. Individuals may apply or nominate someone for membership. More at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456. This message is sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.